on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Officials say Ukraine fired several American-supplied longer-range missiles into Russia, marking the first time Kyiv has used such weapons since the start of the war. A Telegram channel affiliated with the Ukrainian military posted a video on Tuesday that it says shows a U.S.-supplied missile being fired from an undisclosed location in Ukraine. The Kremlin said Tuesday that it shot down five Army Tactical Missile System missiles and damaged a sixth, and that debris fell on an unspecified Russian military facility in the Bryansk region. The use of the long-range missiles came as Russian President Vladimir Putin formally lowered Moscow's threshold for using nuclear weapons. U.S. officials said on Tuesday the Pentagon will send Ukraine at least $275 million in new weapons. It comes as President Joe Biden's administration works to do as much as it can to help Kyiv fight back against Russia in the remaining 2 months before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Trump has vowed to quickly end the war. U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein held what he called very constructive talks with Lebanese officials in Beirut on Tuesday about a possible ceasefire in the Israel-Hezbollah war.
Today, we continued to significantly narrow the gaps.
Hochstein visited Lebanon's capital a day after Hezbollah reportedly gave a positive response to a U.S. draft proposal to end the 13-month war, which the Lebanese group launched to support Hamas in Gaza. The U.S. proposal could see Israeli ground forces leave Lebanon and Hezbollah militants withdraw away from the Israeli border. More Lebanese army troops and UN peacekeepers would be sent to a buffer zone in southern Lebanon as part of the deal. This is VOA News. New York prosecutors who secured the first ever criminal conviction of a former U.S. president said on Tuesday the hush money case against Donald Trump should not be dismissed in light of his election victory. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
78-year-old Trump had been scheduled to be sentenced on November 26th, but Justice Juan Merchan last week put all proceedings on hold at the request of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. And prosecutors raised the possibility of a four-year pause in proceedings, which could resume after Trump leaves the White House. In May, a jury found Trump guilty of falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels. The money was meant to buy her silence before the 2016 election about a sexual encounter she says she had with Trump. Trump denies the affair and pleaded not guilty at trial. Trump's lawyers urged Merchan to dismiss the case, arguing that having it loom over Trump while he was president would cause what they called unconstitutional impediments to his ability to govern.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. The U.S. government has recognized Venezuelan opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez as the president-elect of the South American country months after President Nicolas Maduro claimed to have won the July election. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recognized Gonzalez on Tuesday in a post on X in which he also demanded respect for the will of Venezuelan voters. The Biden administration has said Gonzalez earned the most votes in the disputed July 28th election. Brazilian police announced on Tuesday the arrests of five people suspected of involvement in an alleged plan to kill then-president-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in 2022, days before he took office. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
Brazilian police say President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva could have been killed before his inauguration in 2023. They uncovered a military plot to kill the then president-elect days before he took office and stage a coup. The army confirmed current and retired military officers were arrested, including one who was a member of former President Jair Bolsonaro's cabinet. Documents seized by police show how the plan was to shoot or poison Lula and his vice president-elect, put retired army generals and other officials in charge, and then hold new elections. Lula defeated Bolsonaro in the 2022 election.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Ukraine uses American-supplied weapons on Russia.
A number of media outlets reported that the Ukrainian Defense Forces reportedly used U.S.-supplied Army Tactical Missile Systems, or ATACMS missiles, for the first time to hit inside Russian territory.
Vladimir Putin rewrites his country's nuclear doctrine.
And this is basically saying that there's going to be new conditions under which the country would potentially use its nuclear arsenal.
And President-elect Donald Trump's choice for ambassador to Israel.
Trump-appointed ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, has long been a staunch proponent of Jewish settlements in the West Bank.
Today is Wednesday, November 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. As we've been discussing on the show for the past few days, the United States has given Ukraine permission to use U.S.-supplied weapons to attack targets inside Russian territory, and it looks like they started using them early Tuesday. Ukrainian armed forces struck a military target 200 kilometers inside Russian territory, apparently with U.S.-supplied missiles. For VOA, Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
In the early hours of Tuesday, the Ukrainian military struck a Russian weapons storage facility in the Bryansk region of Russia, approximately 200 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. Ukrainian military officials confirmed the attack, and according to preliminary information, weapons kept at the site included those provided to Russia by North Korea. The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine specified that 12 explosions and a detonation in the area of the target were recorded. The governor of the Bryansk region did not report the destruction of the artillery arsenal, but confirmed that the region was under drone attack. Russian telegram channels published a video that allegedly showed the moment of the shelling. A number of media outlets reported that the Ukrainian Defense Forces reportedly used U.S.-supplied Army Tactical Missile Systems, or ATACMS missiles, for the first time to hit inside Russian territory. Neither Ukrainian nor U.S. officials have confirmed the allegations. President Volodymyr Zelensky did not confirm whether the strike on the Russian ammunition depot was carried out by an American ATACMS missile, but assured that Ukraine has long-range capabilities and will use them. Amid the news that Ukraine might use the U.S. ATACMS missiles for the first time, the Ukrainian president addressed the participants of the European Parliament's extraordinary session, marking 1,000 days of Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He urged Ukrainian allies to put more pressure on Russia and push Putin toward just peace.
Every today is the best moment to push Russia harder, and it's clear without certain key factors, Russia will lack real motivation to engage in meaningful negotiations. The more time he has, the worse the conditions become.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin approved Russia's updated nuclear doctrine, which involves the use of nuclear weapons in the case ballistic missiles are used to attack Russian territory. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Ukraine launched missiles into Russia, and on the same day, Russian President Vladimir Putin revised his country's nuclear doctrine, lowering the threshold to use nuclear weapons. To help sort it all out, Steve spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
So the Russian president approved changes to Russia's nuclear doctrine. And this is basically saying that there's going to be new conditions under which the country would potentially use its nuclear arsenal. Now, with the updates, they are basically saying that if there is an attack from a non-nuclear state, but it's backed by a nuclear power, that Russia will treat it just as a joint assault and can therefore respond with nuclear weapons.
So he's changing the threshold at which Russia will use a nuclear response. Now, this coming the same day that Ukrainians use American-supplied weapons for the first time. This can't be a coincidence.
No, it does not appear to be a coincidence at all, because when you read between the lines, The non-nuclear state is Ukraine, and it is backed by a nuclear power, namely the United States. So, of course, Ukraine and the United States are not named in this. But, you know, this change, having Ukraine striking long, deep inside Russia using long munitions, long-fire munitions, you know, that has clearly triggered something with Russia where they are trying to push back with this change in its nuclear doctrine.
So what's been the Pentagon's reaction to all this?
So I asked Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh about this today, and she essentially said that this is nothing new, that they had expected something like this from Russia. They said that, you know, it's rich in so many words. She said that it's interesting that Russia would try to talk about and imply that some sort of escalation has happened when they and the Pentagon feels that the true escalation was introducing North Korean troops on the battlefield to help fight Russia's fight.
Well, it's no surprise that the Russians and the Pentagon won't see eye to eye on what's going on. So what does this mean going forward? How will American policy, American troop readiness, things like that, what's going to change for the United States?
Well, in the near future, nothing is going to change. Sabrina Singh was very clear. She said that they are going to continue to monitor the situation, but it's the same irresponsible rhetoric that Russia has used before. And that, you know, when you look at the situation, the Pentagon at this point, according to Singh, says that they do not have any indications that Russia is preparing to use a nuclear weapon within Ukraine. And so if they don't see that change, they have not made any changes to their own nuclear posture as well.
VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, thanks for your reporting tonight.
You're welcome.
Meanwhile, in South America, leaders of the group of 20 major economies meeting at the G20 summit in Brazil have called for a comprehensive ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon, while also stressing the need for cooperation on climate change, poverty reduction, and taxing the ultra-rich. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Pansy Wida-Kuswara has the latest from Rio.
As host of the G20 gathering of the world's largest economies, Brazil focused the group on the priorities of the global south, countries generally considered as developing, plus Russia and China. Globalization has failed, said Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
A globalização neoliberal fracassou.
In the midst of ongoing turbulence, the international community seems resigned to sailing aimlessly through hegemonic disputes. We remain adrift, as if swept along by a torrent pushing us towards tragedy.
In a joint statement, the group underscored the need to slow global warming, reduce poverty, and impose a global tax on billionaires. It again called for an expansion of the United Nations Security Council beyond its 5 current permanent members. The statement also called for a ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon and pathway to a two-state solution for Israel and the Palestinians, but did not mention Israel's right to defend itself, a line U.S. President Joe Biden pushes for in various global forums.
I ask everyone to increase the pressure on Hamas.
In last year's summit, G20 leaders highlighted the human suffering and economic impact of the war in Ukraine without any condemnation of Russia. The war is escalating as Ukraine begins using long-range weapons provided by the United States and Britain to strike inside Russian territory. Kyiv accuses the G20 of failing to act. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Today, G20 conference. They're sitting today. And Brazil, did they say something? Nothing. Nothing strong. This is the answer. So what strategy can be if even G20 countries don't have any strong strategy?
Support for Ukraine is on the minds of leaders ahead of the incoming U.S. administration of Donald Trump. President-elect Trump has criticized sending aid to Kyiv. In Biden's meeting with Lula, they underscored the urgent need to address the climate crisis, another area of uncertainty. Trump has repeatedly called climate change a hoax. Brazil ended the summit by passing the baton to South Africa, the next G20 president. Traveling with President Biden in Rio de Janeiro, Patsy Wida-Kuswara, VOA News.
A and here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein says an agreement to end the Israel-Hezbollah war is within our grasp after meeting with officials in Lebanon. It's unclear how close they are to an agreement, which would likely entail both the militants and Israeli ground forces withdrawing from a U.N. buffer zone in southern Lebanon.
Colombian President Gustavo Petro has reversed his support for the July presidential election in neighboring Venezuela, calling the vote a mistake. The key ally of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro spoke in an interview with Brazilian news outlet Globo News. Petro and the leaders of Brazil and Mexico tried to make peace as the election results came under dispute when Maduro and his main opponent both claimed victory. But their effort was not successful.
A Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives introduced a bill aimed at blocking the chamber's first openly transgender member from using women's bathrooms, a move that Democrats denounced on Tuesday. Representative Nancy Mace's bill would prohibit House members and employees from using bathrooms other than those corresponding to their biological sex. This just weeks after the election of Democrat Sarah McBride, a transgender woman, to the House. Mace called her bill common sense and deridingly referred to transgender women as men in a miniskirt. Top House Democrat Hakeem Jeffries called the bill bullying. For her part, McBride said it was a blatant attempt by Republicans to distract from the fact that they have no real solutions to what Americans are facing. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. And today we continue our look at the transfer of power in the U.S. from Joe Biden to Donald Trump with another of the president-elect's staffing choices. Jewish settlers in the West Bank welcome the election of Donald Trump and his choice for U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who once said that there is no such thing as a Palestinian. VOA's Linda Gradstein reports from the Kedumim settlement in the West Bank.
Kedumim is a comfortable bedroom community in the northern West Bank built in the mid-1970s. Daniela Weiss, a fiery settler leader, and her children were one of the first Jewish families to settle here, living in tents with no running water. Today, she hopes President-elect Donald Trump will accept total sovereignty and annexation of the West Bank settlements without provisions for a Palestinian state.
The president of the United States who says to him, I'm going to give you a present. I will give you sovereignty, but you will have to leave something aside. No, it's all ours. The ability to say it is all ours. Why? Because it's the promise of God to Abraham, not to Abraham Lincoln, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, also lives here. He predicted that in 2025, Israel will annex what's known as Area C, the 60% of the West Bank that contains the Jewish settlements and is home to more than 500,000 Jewish settlers. The 2.5 million Palestinians live mostly in what's designated Areas A and B of the West Bank that are under the partial or full control of the Palestinian Authority. Israeli annexation of disputed territory was a feature of the first Trump administration's Middle East policy, which recognized Israeli control over the Golan Heights. Trump-appointed ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, has long been a staunch proponent of Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Like the Israeli settlers, he refers to the territories by their biblical name, Judea and Samaria.
I recognize Judea and Samaria as part of Israel, and I believe that It's most important that we realize that there are more Jews living in Judea and Samaria than most people ever realize, and that those numbers are significant. It's an important part of the security of Israel.
Some analysts, including those who live in the West Bank, say that Israel should be careful about annexing the lands unilaterally. Hodaya Karish Chazoni is the diplomatic correspondent of the hardline newspaper Makor Rishon.
If you really think that, and I think, that sovereignty is one of the things that can make Israel really safe and can ensure her future, you have to do it wisely, and you have to do it hand in hand with the American administration.
Other settlers warn that a decision to annex parts of the West Bank could cause further unrest. Hanan Moses, who lives in Kedumim, is a professor of political science at Herzog College.
אני באופן אישי בעד. אני רק לא רוצה שזה יקרא את החברה הישראלית מבפנים עוד פעם.
I personally support annexation, but I just don't want it to tear the society apart again. There already is a strong settlement movement here, but the left is against it. The division among us weakens us.
Some settler leaders, including Daniela Weiss, want to go even further than annexing the West Bank. They say they are already preparing to rebuild Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip, which were evacuated in 2005. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Kidumim in the West Bank.
And in Africa, the World Bank is helping Malawi's vulnerable communities address the impact of the climate-related disasters that the country has been facing since 2022. Lamech Messina brings us to the Karanga District in northern Malawi in this report, narrated by Scott Walterman.
The Climate Smart Enhanced Public Works Program recruits individuals from Malawi's rural areas to take part in projects aimed at reversing or preventing damage from flooding, drought, and the other effects of climate change. Funded by the World Bank, the $128 million initiative has helped establish tree nurseries for forest regeneration and construct gullies and swales to control soil erosion. Maribel Muthani is the land conservation officer for the Karanga district.
When we do the natural tree regeneration, we know that we'll have good rains. When it comes to floods, when we do the gallery cremation and other things, we reduce the runoff of water from the mountains, which come to the rivers.
Karanga district is one of the areas in northern Malawi hardest hit by climate shocks. Here, the Climate Smart program has seen its participants grow from 13,000 at its start in 2022 to more than 16,000 now. The increase in participants gives people hope for better outcomes in communities whose crops have long been flooded. Approximately 5.7 million of Malawi's 22 million people will face hunger during the lean season from October to March, according to the government. In addition to addressing climate shocks, the program provides wages of about $28 a month to participants.
At the end of the cycle, they get some wages in form of money, which assists them to have the things they do not have easily at the household.
Some participants have used their monthly wages to buy livestock, while others, like Milnes Mbotwa, have put the money into building houses and paying their children's school fees.
I usually save the money in village savings groups for future needs. So far, I've been able to bring electricity to my house and pay school fees for my two children. One of them is now completing secondary school.
Some critics question whether the participants will continue with the project, which ends in 2027, once they stop receiving wages. But project implementers say the participants are already being prepared for this eventuality, as they must work 40 days to get paid for 30 days' work. Austin Kafare facilitates the Climate Smart project in Karanga District.
And we have deliberately stated that they should be working for 10 days as in community contribution, whereby they will work, but they will not receive anything. That in so doing, we are trying to build it in them that they can also work, they can also do the works without even getting anything out of the program.
In the meantime, the villagers say their main challenge is having too few people to carry out the work they say requires more people to achieve immediate results, something project implementers say they're considering addressing. For Lamech Messina in Malawi, I'm Scott Walterman, VOA News.
And finally today, a story out of Minnesota in the northern central part of the United States. A story that captures the diversity within the U.S. and highlights ancient traditions in a modern world. Imagine one day you're a typical high school student, and the next day you're being celebrated as a spiritual leader of a people thousands of kilometers away. Well, that's just what happened to one young man. I spoke with Tenzin Tethong, the chief of VOA's Tibetan service, for more. Tell the folks at home, who is Jule Dorje?
Well, he's a young Tibetan American in Minnesota, and from what we know, he has been recognized as a reincarnated Tibetan Lama.
So this is interesting. He's of Tibetan ancestry, living what would on the outside look like a perfectly normal life for an American teenager. And then one day there's a knock at the door and they say, you are the reincarnation of a Tibetan Lama. How does that work? How does that happen?
This practice of recognizing reincarnated Lama or a person of a religious background is a Tibetan creation, so to speak, a tradition that started in Tibet some 600 years ago. In general, Buddhists and some other Indian faiths, other religious traditions believe in rebirth, right, in general. And in this case, a section of Tibetan Buddhists believed that not only will somebody be reborn, but if the person is highly realized, he can have a say in where he or he will be born. And with that presumption, you know, or belief, Tibetans believe that a very highly realized spiritual master will indicate where he is born, or his colleagues or his students will find where he's reborn.
So in this particular case, do you know how that works? Does the young man in Minnesota say to the Tibetan community, hey guys, I'm really the reincarnation of this Lama? Or are there Lamas in Dharamsala, in Lhasa, saying, I think we got to look at this kid?
Well, each individual case like this varies a lot. Sometimes they have issues where the child displays unusual tendency or attraction to religious symbols and religious people. Sometimes it's parents becoming involved, the mother or father having unusual dreams when the child is born. And sometimes monastic groups or devotees of the previous Lama who's passed away finding indications that the reincarnation child is either in the East or in the West, or in this case in America, and take steps to sort of link up and see if these signs mean anything. So it's a combination of different things that come together.
So what's next for this young man in Minnesota? He's going to go off to a monastery in the Himalayas. Will he become a political figure, a spiritual figure? What does his future hold?
As far as the exile community is concerned, if somebody with such a background goes to a monastery, he's going there primarily to study Buddhism and to become a serious practitioner. And later he may choose to be a teacher, or he may choose not to continue that role as well. That's a possibility too. So in the exile world, it's kind of an open thing.
So if he decides to go back to Minnesota and continue his studies at high school and play football and not participate, that's just the way it goes.
There have been one or two young lamas who were recognized and put into monasteries, and when they became young adults, they chose to drop the monastic lifestyle and become lay people, even getting married, working in regular jobs. So there are cases like that.
Tenzin Tethong is the service chief for VOA's Tibetan Service. Mr. Tethong, thanks for being with us. Thanks for your insight on this interesting story today.
Thank you.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.